Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin, we'd like to talk a little bit about China today, and there's always rumblings in China. We had some encounters with one of their ships just recently. There's been other stories. Jim, you just put out an article this morning on the corruption in the police forces.
Corruption in the police forces has been a big problem in China for a long time. There was probably only a decade, if that, in the 40s and 50s when the police were fairly clean, but they got corrupted real quick, just like everybody else. I mean, corruption is endemic, has been endemic in China for thousands of years, and it tends to be endemic in any country where you have a lot of poor people. You know, taking a bribe is an easy way to instantly increase your standard of living. Unfortunately, as China got rich in the last 30 years, as they had decade after decade of 10% a year GDP growth, the police weren't getting as rich as a lot of the civilians were. And the corruption which had been there, it basically was fully formed and by the after the Cultural Revolution, or actually even during the Cultural Revolution. And the police got greedy. The police also became the pit bulls, you know, the thugs, as it were, for the local Communist Party officials, who were even more greedy. They were getting rich off land deals. You know, if you needed to get all these new business enterprises, you had to get permits. You had to get the permission of the local Communist Party. And if somebody didn't pay what they owed or didn't pay as much as they thought they should have been paid, the cops would be sent. There have been horror stories of foreigners being arrested, corrupt cops at the behest of corrupt officials, at the behest of a corrupt businessman, a Chinese businessman. As they say over there, everybody has their favorite uncles, uncle being a term used for somebody who's connected in some, you know, largely unsavory way. Either it's a corrupt cop or a corrupt politician. But the Chinese, who have to live with that, have been getting angrier and angrier. And there are literally hundreds, possibly thousands, but I mean the Chinese actually admit, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of riots. I'm talking thousands of people throwing things, burning police cars, you know, attacking policemen, in some cases killing them. This is not a big deal in China, it's a regular deal. And actually at the very top, the Communist Party officials running the country are pretty upset about this. I mean, at the very top, and actually all through the Chinese bureaucracy, there is this enormous sense of history. I mean, there are certain things about China that you have to know as a Chinese person of education. And one of the things they have to know is that the dynasties rise and fall with the waves of corruption. In other words, if things get corrupt enough, you're going to be gone. Usually minus your head. There's a lot of talk, a lot of chatter, as we like to say in the intelligence business, in China about the dynasty falling because of, you know, unsustainable corruption. And the people understand this, and the leaders understand this. The problem is nobody has an easy solution to eliminating it because you have these millions of police and officials between the leaders at the very top, a few thousand people who basically run everything, and the, you know, the hundreds of millions of people at the bottom. You have these millions of officials who basically their life is sticking their hand in somebody else's pocket, taking a bribe or just taking something. And he's come up with a magic, you know, elixir, which is going to, you know, make all these people honest all of a sudden. And so until they come up with a solution, the leadership sees themselves basically in a slow motion car wreck that they cannot stop. And this is what defines China right now. And this is why China is making all these noises about war with the foreign devils. I mean, books are being written about this using that same sort of, you know, rhetoric to try and distract people from the things they're really angry at. And that's basically the corrupt cops.
Right. Now, one of the...
Dan, let me,
Yeah, go ahead, Boston.
To the mix here. Jim's described, I think, very succinctly the issue of the mid-level, corrupted mid-level officials and police, members of security apparatus. Army's gone through this as well, particularly 10, 12 years ago. The Army was a source of extraordinary corruption. The Army was owning things like nightclubs in Shanghai. For all I know, there may still be some interest with this, but the military looked at it, and there was at least a beginning of a push to try to deal with the economic and political corruption. I'll let Jim comment on how successful that's been, but at least the military was aware of it. In the same way that Jim says, the upper echelons are aware of the threat from a deeply disaffected population that says we're being cheated, and this everything we make is stolen from us. The other component, and this is extremely complex, is that you see this figure that anywhere between 80 and 100 million, it could be more, Westerners moved east because that's really where the Chinese economy expanded, and the eastern port cities, the eastern economic zones. And as the global recession has set in, many of these people have lost their jobs. They were marginal workers to begin with. The Chinese government has moved a number of them back to the farms. How are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Beijing or Shanghai? Well, that's another problem. And actually, there have been several articles I've seen in the mainstream media in the last month mentioning this phenomenon. The reporters are out in the Western China, and they're talking to these people who've been working in some of these smaller factories and economic enterprises in the East, and now they've been returned home. This is another source of disaffection and concern. This is one of the reasons the Chinese government is so insistent on having access to the U.S. market. Because if there's going to be any recovery or sustain what they have economically, they've got to export. And when they hear the U.S. administration or Europe talk about protection and protectionism, and maybe they talk about it with code words, the Chinese get very, very concerned about this. My read, and you can see this in a couple of recent columns, is that some of the trouble we've had with the Chinese, letting the North Koreans run loose on a very, very long leash, is that it's not so much a straight political test of a new American administration, but it's, you know, if you want us to participate and achieve some of the security goals that are in the interest of the United States, you're going to have to pay attention to our economic interests, and our economic interests are, wait a second, we've got to keep this quasi-capitalist wealth generation that we have been, this has been the way we've paid off the people to let the Communist Party continue in power. We don't want to be squirrels in this, keeping this cage spinning. But part of the way that we're going to sustain ourselves is to maintain some degree of wealth, and that means we got to export and sell things to you. So don't tell us you're going to cut off the market. Now, I don't think that's a stretch. I've noticed that some commentators say, "Oh, the Chinese aren't thinking that way." I'd be interested in Dunnigan's response to that. Do they think that way, Jim?
Well. No, there are things that are said for export, so to speak, and things that are said for the domestic market. Everybody understands, all the world leaders understand what happened in 1929 and the 1930s. If you don't trade, you die. Now, a lot of countries have had their exports go through the floor in the last year. Russia, I think, is the top. They're like almost 50% down, but that's got a lot to do with the price of oil. but a lot of the East Asian countries, including China's not doing that as bad as many others. Taiwan is doing worse. But they all understand this is a temporary thing. In fact, some of them are getting orders again, because what we have to blame for a lot of what has been going on with this recession is Japan. And let me explain that quickly. Japan invented just-in-time manufacturing, where you basically tightened up the supply chain. In other words, the time it took to order a part for something you're building and to get it and actually to put it in the thing you're building and then send it out to the, you know, to be sold. The Japanese shortened this a great deal, which meant you had very tight inventory. And they basically created, and this is in the last, in the 70s and 80s, it created this fundamental change in how you dealt with inventory. In other words, you dealt with it very quickly. And this is the first big recession we've had since just-in-time inventory, you know, that changed the whole landscape of inventory control. You can tell I used to go to accounting school when I was in college. But anyway, when things started to go south with this recession, everybody had these hair trigger, you know, controls on their inventory, and they cut off everything, boom, just like that. And so they rapidly, you know, reduced their inventories, because they had such control over them, which meant you saw these dramatic drops in exports. I mean, you heard these stories from China that, my God, thousands of factories are closing. That's because the economy has become more efficient. That's why we don't have as many recessions as we used to. That's something you can't get on the news because it's good news and good news doesn't sell. But the downside of this good news is things move a lot more quickly, including orders to stop sending me parts. And we're not just talking about one level. We're talking about two, three, or four levels. You know, for example, parts that go into making an automobile use parts from several other sources. So we're seeing this whole thing with the speed of light, literally. People get on their computers, or a lot of it actually. Walmart, for example, pioneered the use of automated inventory controls where there's a man in the loop somewhere, but basically it's all done by computer. But everybody understands at the national leadership level that you don't mess with trade. They talk that for domestic consumption.
Right.
Jim, your argument, your contention is that the Chinese understand that the United States really understands that, so they don't have to play a threat game?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just understood. I mean, that's what I hear down on Wall Street. Everybody tells me, you know, I'm hearing no conspiracy theory stories about the Chinese really have a plan. I mean, it's a game you can't win. It's mutually assured destruction.
I didn't mean that. I think the signs that the Chinese are concerned that the United States would curtail exports, try to use the American market as an economic tool on this, and some of the things that
they're
concerned about those. They're new unemployed. They fit
they're somewhat concerned about their unemployed, but basically the way they, first of all, exports are a much smaller part of the Chinese economy than most people. It's less than 10%. And 20 million unemployed, which is a bit exaggerated, is a minuscule, you know, the Chinese workforce, you're talking like 400 million people. 500 million people. It's a huge workforce. So 20 million is nothing. You know, you say, people tell me 20 million. I say, 20 million compared to what? And when you're talking about China, I'm saying it's nothing. I mean, you got 20 million people having a hard time. But the good side of that is, the people who, the companies have been able to increase their productivity because they've been able to get rid of a lot of the people who were, the cabooses, as it were, you know, the people who were not the most efficient workers. So now they're basically becoming more effective and more efficient because they had a labor shortage the last few years in China, if you can believe that. I mean, literally, wages were actually going up because they couldn't hire enough people. So, again, you have to take the news with a grain of salt. Because the news is one thing. They're looking for headlines, and headlines have to be bad news and what have you. But the people at the top They may disagree on how to get from point A to point B, but that's what Obama is encountering over with the G20 right now. You know, how do we recover from get our economies, you know, going at rising levels again? But they don't disagree that we have to go from point A to point B. Everybody's in agreement on that. So a lot of this stuff you're hearing is purely politics, public relations. You basically, the best thing you can tell your people when there's a recession, when a lot of people are out of work, is we're not going to send jobs overseas. I mean, that's always been, you know, a crap statement, you know, meaningless, really. But it's popular, and it's politics, as the saying goes. You got to say something, so you say that, but have you noticed that nobody ever acts on it?
Right. I mean,
we've all been around for a while. We're not spring chickens. We've heard these lines and then noticed that the other shoe never drops.
Right. Well,
so that's what's going on.
Now,
one of the things that speaks to that, too, is the Obama administration's complete reneging on threats about NAFTA and the like. I agree with that. I do think the Chinese are concerned because about the exports, because that's been part of their premium. That's been part of what makes a difference on not just out of the domestic market. That's foreign.
Well, no, the big
foreign
the big thing.
And they've got,
well, no, the big thing with, and this is what Chinese tell me. The big thing they get from exports is expertise and technology. Because what they promise to do, one reason they're so cheap is they'll practically give it away. If you'll send your people in to set up a first class, like fabricating a fab, you know, making chips, microprocessors, they will give you all the concessions you could possibly want. But you're going to build that fab there, and you're going to use Chinese workers, and you're going to bring in your people, and you're going to train Chinese to make world-class electronics. Now, you can see the obvious payoff on that. The foreigners help you build the first fab, maybe the first two or three, because it is complex. But by fab 3, 4, or 5, you got Chinese engineers building it. You're stealing all the foreigner technology. So that's why they want a lot of these foreign factories. They want the technology and the expertise they haven't got.
Let me ask you a question, then, Jim. This is a segue, and it's several things that we've had on strategy page over the last few months. Has that worked in terms of jet engines?
Yes, it has. The trouble with jet engines, again, a jet engine has, I don't know, 50,000 parts, but not only that, a jet engine requires a lot of bleeding-edge technologies, a lot of metallurgy, chemistry. I mean, it's just a lot of complex technology. And the Chinese found themselves climbing the same learning curve that the Russians are still climbing. I mean, you know, remember during the Cold War, you'd hear Russian jet engines would only last 500 hours, whereas an American or Western jet engine would last, you know, 5,000 hours. Well, the Russian engines still aren't up to Western standards, and they have complete access. You know, they can license any technology they want. And they're still, I mean, they're closer than they were, you know, at the end of the Cold War, but they're still somewhat below, you know, the top level, you know, the Seneca, you know, the French, the Rolls-Royce, and the American Pratt & Whitney and GE, you know, the majors, as it were. But China is still climbing that. But what China has learned, they know where they are in this process. And we did a piece on this in Strategy Page in the last month or so. They believe, they're planning on the basis that they are 5 or 10 years away from getting up to where, you know, close enough as far as they're concerned to the top four, which means they can make any engine they need themselves. No more dependence on Russia or anybody else for that matter. So GE and Pratt & Whitney are not happy about this development because they know the Chinese will start building engines for commercial aircraft, which is where the real money is, not military aircraft. And you know, people in business, they understand what China is doing. They're buying their way into the 20th century. And I don't mean that facetiously. As far as China is concerned, they're not quite into the late 20th century yet. And they don't expect to catch up with the United States for another 40, 50 years. But when they do, remember what Napoleon said, you know, China's the sleeping dragon. When it awakes, the world will tremble. Of course, a lot of things can go wrong between here and there, but that's another story.
Right. Now, one of the things I'm interested in, Austin and Jim, is I learned how many different ethnic groups there are in China, and it's just overwhelming.
And they don't like each other very much.
Right. And so my question is what sort of ethnic tensions do they face? How are they dealing with it? What sort of problems is it causing them?
Let me lay one bit out on this before we get into it. Understand that China also has the world's largest ethnic group, and that's the Han Chinese. I've seen various figures. A new edition of Quick and Dirty Guide to War, the fourth edition, give you some that we could be between 900 and possibly a billion Han Chinese. So that's the overwhelming ethnic group. But that still leaves you with 200 to 300 million,
well, others.
Rough figures, others, exactly. And some of them range from various out west, particularly you get into Turkic peoples, and the Uyghurs are restless. They've been restless for decades, and the Tibetans are certainly restless, and they've been restless for over 50 years. So,
yeah, you go around the borders of China, and you'll find it nothing but one long succession of others, because these are all the people who didn't want to become part of the Han Empire, and they fled. And of course, the Chinese never quite caught up with them, but they're on the borderlands. The Vietnamese, for example, a lot, especially in North Vietnam, they're ethnically Chinese, but a group that were trying to escape over 1,500 years ago. So it's really not just an ethnic thing; it's a tradition to get away from the Han. And the Han can be very overbearing about this because they call themselves the Middle Kingdom. And they're talking middle of the world, not just the middle of China.
Right.
What we call racism is considered, normal in East Asia. Whether it be Korean or Japanese or Chinese, they all have very high opinions of themselves. I mean, no self-esteem problems there.
What sort of problems does it cause internally for them, and how are they controlling it?
People don't trust each other as much as they should. I mean, this is why you got a lot of the corruption. It's taking care of your own. The family is still very important in China. It's the same kind of corruption that you see crippling the Middle East. You never get away from family. There's always going to be nepotism. But in the United States, it's considered news. In other words, bad news. If some politician is nepotistic, that retires all his nieces and nephews and what have you. Now, that happens anyway, but it's considered bad form. Whereas in much of the world, it's considered that's the way things are. And that's why people like to come to the United States.
We're going to be in bad form if we don't address one subject. Is China a threat, a national security threat to the United States?
Well, that is more... that's true, but it's more of a problem where we're not paying attention to what they're doing, which is what we're trying to explain here. What are they trying to do? I mean, for example, their electronic warfare operations, I think in the long term, and as from a historical point of view, will turn out to have been decisive, because they're getting all sorts of stuff that nobody's admitting to. We're talking, military secrets, diplomatic secrets. I mean, they just sent vacuum cleaners in. And, of course, they're not talking. They deny everything. Like this latest deal with the Dalai Lama. I mean, they have such economic internet cyber warfare resources that they can go after they can put the full court press on the Dalai Lama and his organization. And this is big. And this could be decisive in wartime.
Austin?
But then again, we may be doing the same thing to them. Nobody talks about it.
I see China in many ways as playing a very, very close hand. Obviously, Jim and I disagree about their current tactics and operations, about why they might be doing some of the probing, and I also think they have let North Korea run on a longer leash, because our approach... Our Python strategy and the sunshine policy of South Korea rely on China acquiescing to South Korea and the United States, and occasionally putting pressure, economic pressure, political pressure, on the North Koreans, and that doesn't seem to be apparent right now with this forthcoming or alleged launch about to come up.
The Chinese don't care as long as it doesn't become a mess for them. I mean,
they don't want a war in the peninsula, and that's bad. And I think ultimately,
they less mind a war between North Korea and South Korea than they would a collapse of North Korea, which would send millions of refugees into northern China.
Well,
that's what really bothers them.
What I was going to get into is the Chinese.
If South Korea got trashed, that would eliminate one of their economic competitors. Also a trading partner, but hell, there's plenty of trading partners.
Well, the Chinese ultimately see a reunited Korea as like a little bulldog biting into them. I mean,
the last thing they want is a strong, united Korea. I mean, a Chinese nightmare is a united Korea as economically powerful as South, with the same GDP per head capita as South Korea has now. Who needs that on their border?
With an alliance with the United States and decent relationship with Japan. But China is long range. This is they want to modernize. I think they want to avoid a major conflict with their neighbors and with the United States. And they've been extremely canny. And I think they've been extremely canny since really the late 70s, early 80s, Deng Xiaoping, the four modernizations, and yet Deng Xiaoping could point to Zhou Enlai at one of the party conferences talking about the need to modernize. So he was not rooting it in Mao, but rooting it in Zhou Enlai. Deng Xiaoping was a very canny, long-range thinker. Yes, he was the leader that ordered Tiananmen Square, 2,000 people killed in 1989. But that's the game they're up to, and I really see them as
you got to remember they have several insurmountable problems, but the one that will kill them right now in getting to the same economic and military level as the United States is the pollution. In other words, China has not got the ecological infrastructure to bring the population up to the level the population expects. In other words, the Chinese police state has remained in power by bribing the entire population with a rising economy. I mean, if this were a Stalinist police state, the state would have most of the money and everybody would just be getting by. But what Deng did, Deng's genius was, it's glorious to get rich. Hey, everybody, go out there, party on. The trouble is, China has four times our population, about the same amount of land, and the land is not as, how should I put it, as ecologically beneficial as North America. It's drier. It's more eroded in many places. It's been lived on for a lot longer. And because it's a police state and it's corrupt, a lot of these pollution problems they're trying to cover them up, and they keep coming up. We've seen some of these food contamination, but there's other water contamination. They got a lot of problems. And as China gets wealthier, it gets dirtier. And where's Al Gore when we need him?
Right. We might leave at that, because I think we've actually got a good segue to the ending here. Dan, Communist Party on is what...
exactly, yeah. good turn of phrase.
Jim's phrase there. I know he didn't mean that. But anyway, there you are. All right?
All right. Well, that sounds good, gentlemen. We'll talk to you next time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.